In today's show, we have Tim Nolan. Tim is the Technical Director of Automation and Engineering at Data Science Automation out of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. I met Tim at the University of Pittsburgh, and today we're going to talk about industrial automation and programming embedded devices.
If you're ready to learn how technology is driving business innovation in Cincinnati and beyond, you're tuned in to the right podcast. Join us for interviews and discussions with business leaders, innovators, and visionaries. With our host, Sam Schulte, CEO of Unstoppable Software. This is Unstoppable Talk.
Tim, welcome to the show.
Thanks a lot, Sam. It's good to be here.
Yeah, absolutely. Great to have you on. So maybe a good way to start our conversation is tell me a little bit about how you got into this as a career.
Sure thing. So data science automation is where I'm at right now. But those skills go back to, like you mentioned, at the University of Pittsburgh. When I was a graduate student in bioengineering, Pitt calls it bioengineering. A lot of other places call it biomedical engineering, but it's artificial organ design and things like that. My main responsibilities in the lab were lab automation, data collection, data analysis, things that were used with a number of programs like LabVIEW and MATLAB and associated programs. And so that's what I ended up doing my thesis work with and some kind of specialized sensor work. And that, of course, was then a big part of my resume that I kind of had up there. And I was contacted directly by DSA for having known LabVIEW and MATLAB. And that was the kind of thing they were recruiting for. So that's what got me in as my entry-level programming position there back in 2006.
Okay, so yeah, so basically the tools that you used, even though you were studying biomedical engineering and stuff in school, the software tools you were using is what you ended up really cashing in on, sort of, and spending most of your time on in your career since then.
Yeah, absolutely. It's really been the kind of tools expertise, and that's kind of what DSA presents, is a tools expertise rather than any specific industry as well. So it aligned well from that side of things.
Great. And so when you kind of started with DSA and in this field, you know, what was one of your kind of first big projects you worked on, or one of the kind of more game-changing things you did or that was interesting to you?
Well, I had a real nice lead-in. You know, I had more senior engineers who kind of took me under their wing and got me up to training, got me up to DSA standards. And actually kind of bittersweet because he literally retired yesterday.
Hmm.
Ben Rayner, one of the big names in the LabVIEW world. But you know, so I had several years of experience, and then I finally got to be a lead engineer on a big project. And in that project, it was an embedded monitoring system. So a lot of times you can run LabVIEW or what have you on a computer, you know, so you have a Windows PC and it has hardware connected to it and you can gather data from that. But for long-term systems, you want a kind of more deterministic operating system. So you need to start going into what we call real-time systems.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a separate operating system. So at that time, we were using FARLAP, which was one of the OSs on what they called the Field Point system. Yeah, crazy name. I think it's named after a horse from Baltimore. Like it was like a thoroughbred racehorse or something. And then those real-time systems have moved on to like VxWorks and RT Linux. Like VxWorks is like what's running the Mars rovers, I think, right now.
Hmm.
But this was an embedded system for coal plant monitoring.
Okay.
So we needed something super robust that could be halfway up a smokestack and wouldn't care about freezing weather or hot weather. So it was this ruggedized industrial computer that had to basically constantly maintain all of the variables that were going on. So what's the flow rate through the smokestack? What's the temperature? And everything like that, because it was connected to a sampling system that was kind of pulling out little samples of the smoke. So that went into a device that measured how much mercury was being emitted into the atmosphere. So for the EPA regulations at the time, every smoke stack had to basically have one of these monitors on it. And, you know, we had to run in all kinds of temperatures, had to run for a long time without anybody looking at it, and actually didn't even have, you know, a screen that you can interact with it. We had developed at that time basically a PDA that you could walk up to it. It would connect wirelessly. You could check all the data. You could pull data off and then walk away. So you didn't have to have a screen that was there all the time.
Yeah. So, Tim, you mentioned real-time operating systems. For folks that might not be familiar with that, can you explain you know, why you might need a real-time operating system as opposed to using something just like Windows.
Sure thing, Sam. Now, in general, a lot of people are familiar with Windows, but as I'm sure we all know, Windows can crash on occasion. So It is not something that you use for long-term support and not something that is amazingly reliable. So what we have in a real-time operating system is what we call determinism. Now, Windows is a general-purpose operating system, and it's great for what it does. You can do all kinds of things. You can have a network in place. You can be having virus checking. You can have all that kind of stuff independent, but they also interfere with each other. So they will have the virus checker interfere and lock up your system for a little bit. On a real-time operating system, you have what's known as determinism, like I mentioned. You have a bunch of processes, but they operate in a hierarchy. So the top-level process that you want to make your most deterministic, nothing can interrupt it. If it needs the processor, if it needs the resources of the system, it gets it. And then there are all kind of descending orders of priority below that of other processes. So you can always predict the order in which things will happen, and certain things won't preempt each other. And that gives you a level of reliability, number one, in that your main process is operating in a loop that's deterministic as far as time, has low jitter, and you know your loop rate and your acquisition rate or whatever you're aiming for is always happening at the same rate, but also it can't get interrupted. So it's managing the memory and managing the processor, and that gives you long-term stability and helps you prevent system crashes if it's implemented correctly.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, I would imagine, obviously, if you're running a nuclear power plant or something, you can't have the thing pause to install virus updates and the entire system drags, right?
For instance, yeah, exactly.
And, you know, all those kind of applications. So you had mentioned, you know, and your time there at Data Science Automation. Can you tell me a little bit about the company and sort of its history and how it got started? I think it had been going for quite some time when you joined, I believe.
Yeah, very true. We go back to 1993. Our founder and still president, Rich Brugman, had actually kind of been doing this job internally in Pittsburgh Plate Glass, so the local company in Pittsburgh. His job was internally to go around to the other departments and get people to kind of pay his funding to automate their systems. And he kind of realized, well, you know, I could do this on my own.
Yeah.
And so he founded the company back then. And, you know, we work in kind of the research, manufacturing, government, business operations. It's all across the board. And even from an early time, he realized that he could kind of spread out and do a number of things. So, you know, we acquire, we analyze, present, manage data. We design, simulate, test, and validate products. We monitor, predict, control, and optimize processes. And even we invent, draft, prototype, and build machines. We just delivered a, 10-foot-tall surgical light test machine that was kind of fully integrated and built in-house. So we do the full turnkey systems, however, whatever level you need. And early on as well, he was very dedicated to teaching and education. So he was teaching LabVIEW as a course, as well as implementing it as a consultant. So he was actually the first certified LabVIEW certified instructor outside of National Instruments, the company that makes LabVIEW, back in the day. And we were the first certified training center outside of National Instruments as well. So two halves of our business have been in there since the beginning, both the consulting and the training side.
Great. And so you mentioned LabVIEW. A lot of folks may not be familiar with LabVIEW and kind of why it is different as a programming environment. So can you talk a little bit about what it is and how it's different?
Sure thing. LabVIEW, as you said, not too familiar. I was rather amused in the past couple of years that they actually rank programming languages by use. And LabVIEW, I think, is 36th or 37th at the moment. So we're beating Hadoop, but not many others. So what LabVIEW is, it's the graphical programming language. So if you look at somebody programming in LabVIEW, it might not look like programming or your traditional type line by line as you'd see in Python or C# or anything like that. You have functional blocks that you connect by wires. And ultimately, it's a different philosophy of programming because it's data flow rather than control flow. So as data is available to each node, like you can imagine like water in a pipe or electricity in a circuit, it operates on that item and then gives output on the other side. it was developed by essentially a bunch of PhDs, standard Silicon Valley. I mean, only now we're in Austin, Texas, rather than California, but in some guy's garage, namely Dr. Truchard and Jeff Kadosky. Jeff Kadosky was the programming side of NI back then. They just said, this is something we need to control our instruments. And they developed it as an accessory to the hardware production of Natural Instruments, where they were making things like GPIB cards and data acquisition cards. And they just created out of whole cloth, really. So it has a bunch of interesting things in place. Like, it's inherently a parallel language. If I have parallel wires on a system, it'll operate in a parallel level. I don't have to write any extra code for parallel operations. But yeah, its main strength is instrument control. So automation, acquisition, getting a bunch of different kinds of hardware to talk to each other is kind of what it was built around and where its wheelhouse really lies.
And it sounds like out of box, it can run on some of these real-time operating systems you mentioned too, just sort of, it's built to handle those as well.
It is. I mean, they're different like toolkits. Like you get LabVIEW and then you get LabVIEW Real-Time or LabVIEW FPGA or LabVIEW Motion that are kind of specialized that just kind of give you an extra set of palettes when you're working with them in the development environment.
We've talked about this before a little bit, I think, but, you know, is there anything that you could do in, say, C# that you can't do in LabVIEW? I mean, can you build entire, you know, enterprise systems in LabVIEW, or is there any restriction there? I mean, I guess there's best use, like you kind of said, but...
Right. Like, I would never go and try to build the word processor in LabVIEW, for example. It would not be its use case. Mm-hmm. But there are very large enterprise systems that are done. You know, you can do factory-level systems and factory-level automation. They're using it to control the Large Hadron Collider. So a lot of the fine magnetic adjustments that need to be made at a fast speed, they again use the compact RIO system, which is another embedded real-time controller, to do very fast adjustments of operations at that level. Mm-hmm. So, and people are using it, like we mentioned, in very critical applications, such as on naval vessels and in nuclear engineering and aerospace and so on. So,
yeah, it seems to me like, we've done some work recently, for instance, pulling data off of, you know, say PLCs or devices and stuff. And, you know, if you're doing that at a sort of a, you know, base programming language like C# or something, you know, you're opening the connection, you're pulling it down and then running a SQL query against the data, whatever. It's all very atomic, right?
Right.
Or line by line. And so I could see where if you just kind of had a block, you could just plug in and say, pull the data, done. You
know, yeah, exactly.
That it could be a tremendous time saver and probably, you know, prevent a lot of errors, especially if it also can be parallel.
Yeah, because you also get a certain amount of the advantage that a lot of Macintosh users do, because the program is built for the hardware and the hardware is built for the programming, because you a large section of LabVIEW stuff is from National Instruments hardware. So that gives you an understanding and a synergy that is kind of built in from the ground up.
Let's take a quick break. This podcast is sponsored by Unstoppable Software, a Cincinnati-based technology consulting firm. At Unstoppable Software, we bolt on to your company's team and accelerate their ability to deliver custom software development projects. With our deep experience in manufacturing, engineering, and healthcare, we can tailor systems for process improvement, data analytics, machine learning, and document workflow, so they become a user-friendly, perfect fit for your employees and the way they want to work. To learn more about how we make our clients unstoppable, visit us at unstoppablesoftware.com or call us at 513-382-8499. And now, back to Unstoppable Talk.
So when you started at DSA, you were a developer there, I guess, correct? And now you're a technical director of automation and engineering. So how has that role changed? I mean, do you manage a staff of people there, kind of in charge of all the projects and programming side, or what is your role kind of there now?
So I have done all of those things. I was in the middle of that a program manager and a project manager. So I would manage projects and control a team. And it's not like I have a set number of direct reports, because there's another director and another project manager, two other project managers actually at DSA. So we kind of form teams for the length of a project and then release those teams, and they might be working at the end of those things. Now, that's the project management level, which I'd kind of started about 7 years ago. And, you know, I learned that on, you know, how to focus more on the communication and the registration and the requirements coverage and budgetary and things like that. But as we're growing as a company, we realized we want to make sure that we have kind of internal processes set up, and that we also have things that are making it so our president doesn't have to do everything. You know, that's always the trap of being a founder, right? Because, you know, for so many years, you are HR and you are sales and you are marketing and you are, the, you know, operations wing. And, you know, it's not what you want your CEO doing. So Jeff, the other director there, and I have taken on more roles, such as, for example, I'm in charge of our internal training. So I kind of meet with a lot of the engineers and make sure they can get their certifications. And then I'm also in charge of our internal testing standards. So when we make our unit tests and we make our acceptance testing for factory acceptance or site acceptance, I make sure that we're adhering to industry standards and that our customer is satisfied with the kind of tests that we're putting together. So I'm that's why I'm in charge of engineering and automation. For example, Jeff is in charge of operations as his director position. So he's more of, what is the staffing? How are we billing? How's the balance going out for that? Is all of our data being managed internally? So on. So we kind of divide and conquer from that perspective.
Awesome. Cool. Yeah, it's interesting. It's a pretty neat role to move in to, you know, having been a developer, to move into that role. That's kind of what everybody wants to do eventually, is move into sort of running the show more. So that's great. So, and when you mentioned testing and some of these things, standards and that you're having to develop for your customers, that kind of reminded me of, or made me want to ask, you know, what are some of the key needs that are out there that your customers have in the industry that's really kind of driving change on their side, and really kind of pushing them into working with you guys on projects?
Well, I know it sounds kind of trite, but a lot of our customers are looking for efficiency, because it's from everything from right now, a user is writing something on a clipboard and be much faster to just pull that into a computer and get it in place, to their analysis of the data is somebody staring at an Excel sheet for 5 days and they can't, you know, they can't make it happen any faster. But it, I know you're asking about what is the industry driving here, but we are kind of interesting as well, because depending on where we're going, we're seeing different technological levels. I mean, we're in Pittsburgh, of course, so there's a lot of steel applications around here. And we'll go into a steel application, and it's the finest technology 1970 could give you. And we're needing to update that. Yeah, or even just, frankly, a lot of the government institutions. You know, like I mentioned, I started in 2006 at DSA, and my first job was we had to migrate from Windows XP to, Windows 98. We had to migrate something out of Windows 98 into Windows XP, because they weren't supporting Windows 98 anymore. So quite often you have to hit a lot of those things. But we have a lot of, like I mentioned, research and cutting edge technology people, and there are several things that are becoming really big. Yeah, it's funny, back in 1993, when Rich founded the company, he was like, okay, we're all about data, we're all about science, and we're all about automation. Great, we have a name. But now data science is coming into its own as a thing. And, you know, we've actually, over the years, got a lot of experience with that. We participate with the Pittsburgh Tech Council, and we actually present at the data science conference locally in town. And I bring that up just because it's called I Love It When You Call Me Big Data. And the interesting thing is, at those conferences, basically the first step in everybody's presentation is, okay, so say you have your giant block of data. Well, we're the step right before that. We're real experts at getting machines to report their current status and get more and more information back to the user as it's going on. And that's reflected in things like operations management. So for example, somebody wants to be in their office and say, what is every machine on my floor doing right now? because that tells them how much output they're getting, you know, which machine's breaking down all the time, and who's, you know, is it getting fixed in enough time, you know, more kind of information that gets fed into like the industrial engineering side of things. And then even beyond that, we're getting into condition monitoring. So it's to the point where, you know, in a factory, beyond, you know, my machines that are making anything, I have air conditioners and fans and so on. And normally you just run them and then they break down and you fix them. But if you put things like accelerometers on there, you can start seeing the bearing going out of alignment. You can start to see things wear out. So you can do preventative maintenance earlier and then fix them earlier. And to that end, we've expanded that into a number of our customers are like power companies and so on, where they are wanting to monitor their, you know, these giant breakers. You know, you have the little breakers in your house, but with these giant 8-foot long ones that they put on the power poles or even the transformers to make sure that, hey, is this about to fail and can I fix it now rather than blacking out a city block or whatever the case is.
And I imagine, are you guys getting into like, you know, when you talk about prediction, applying artificial intelligence to some of that as well, machine learning?
We would like to. I mean, I'm sure a number of people are like, yes, we're doing that immediately. And, you know, it's, you know, everybody.
Nobody really
is. Nobody really is. Now,
everybody would like to,
yeah.
Basically.
Now, yeah. We do a lot of learning, but at a very lower level. So a big thing that we were doing, I mentioned, is testing and inspection. And something that we've really gained as a skill over the past few years is visual inspection systems. So you take pictures with cameras and you can measure, you know, alignments, and you can measure even, you know, sizes. You know, you can, the camera becomes your ruler, the camera becomes your caliper, saying, hey, are these two flanges far enough apart? Has this been put in the right location? And to that end, we're starting to put learning algorithms in place where it can be like, okay, these are good ones and these are bad ones, and I can train you on what a passing and failing system is. And even too, we found that a lot of our customers, they want OCR, you know, they want it to, hey, look at this and read what was printed on it, you know, even to check that their printer's working. And every single font is different. So you have to retrain the computer to their font quite often in order to get that information off.
Yeah. Interesting. So when companies are putting these kind of systems in, what kind of ROI are they getting, and how do you measure that?
That is a big important part, and it even goes back to our sales process. You know, it's an early thing that we ask our customers, and we're like, hey, you know, we can make what you're asking us to do, and we can accomplish it, but if it costs you $2 million and you save $100,000, I don't think we're going to go forward in the business. So why don't we visit the ROI as one of the first things? You know, when I get a sales call, or I make a sales call, that's what I'll say. It's like, hey, we're trying to improve this thing. What saving will that get you? And over what period of time? And, you know, what is it? When do you have to realize that as well? Because these are things that a company, you know, I can't decide for a company, do they need a 2-year return on investment? Do they need a 5-year? Do they need a 2-quarter return on investment? You know, depending on where they're at. And the savings come in a lot of places, right? So, you know, I can speed things up. So if I can produce more widgets per hour, then I make more money and the return on investment is there. But then there's also a lot of cost just of quality, right? So if I have a system that tests things efficiently and I can get to non-destructive testing, then, you know, I'm not at the highest level. You know, if I crash a car to crash test it, I can't then sell that car, right? And you'll see that in a lot of other smaller applications. Or even cost of failure. You know, if I have a system that is more precise than somebody putting it together with their fingers, then maybe those devices that come off are, you have a lower failure rate. Or especially, it's like, if I can test to the level that you never have an escapement from the factory, you know, I don't want something going out into the world and being like, oh, it failed there. Because that can be very, very costly, because at that point they have to question everything and pull everything back, you know, stop a recall kind of thing.
Exactly.
And we try to take them through that whole line of reasoning across all of those, because, you know, savings come from a lot of places. And, you know, it's not just, you know, hey, you have to pay one less person to put these things together. It's the return comes from a lot of places.
Yeah, I think I find, and you probably do as well, there's a broad spectrum of value and savings and gain, right? And the hardest ones to pull in and assess are the intangible ones. I mean, I've had people that, you know, want to rebuild a system because they that makes them feel good, makes their employees happy, right? Stuff like that. And that is a value. And there is, but it's very intangible. What is the dollar value of that a year? Hard to say. Obviously, the on the other end of saying, well, this saves us 30 cents per minute or something. You can do that math, right?
Yeah.
Do you think companies are happy to work with you on that sort of doing that sort of ROI assessment? Or because a lot, you know, I think a lot of times when people call engineering and technology companies, they kind of want to just ask, like, well, do you have these skills? Do you have skills X, Y, and Z? And then are you really good at them? Like, that's their assessment.
Right.
Right.
And we address that in a couple different ways. Number one, we'll tell customers off the bat, if there's a solution that you can just go buy and screw together and it will work, we're not the people to hire. You know, we are the people who are making the custom situations where there is not a ready solution for you. And, you know, we're fine to let everybody else have that kind of business.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, of course, they do want to know, do we have the skills? And that is another reason why our kind of internal certification drive is so high. You know, we want to be able to say, I have this many certified LabVIEW architects. I have this many certified LabVIEW embedded developers. And while there are a certain amount of architects out there in the world, you know that they have gone through a minimum level of training. You're not getting some guy who had LabVIEW for a semester in college and is now calling themselves a consultant.
Mm-hmm.
But it is kind of a sales question. You know, we have to make sure that they're qualified and that, you know, we're qualified to help them out. We don't want to waste their time. They don't want to waste our time. So we'll often take them down through what we call the pain funnel, which sounds a lot more heavy metal than it actually is. You know, because we need to figure these things out. Like, oh, well, we're getting rejections on the line. Well, why does that matter? Oh, well, it slows down the process. Okay, well, I'm sure that's okay, right? No. If it slows down the process, then I have to hire another guy. Okay, well, what happens if you have to... Well, if I have to hire another guy, I'm going to get fired because my... Oh, okay, now we're at... where it affects you and where it's going to affect the company. And then therefore it's a lot easier to say, okay, this is where I want it. Cause I can't sell somebody. I can't make them decide to buy from us. I need to find out from them. Is this a good fit? And can we solve their problems? Because we're here to make them more efficient. We're here to make them more successful at their job. And there has to be a gap there. There has to be a, what can we improve and how we're going to make your life better before we can proceed forward.
Well, and you can't want it more than they do.
Absolutely not.
They have to want to improve. And if you show them how to improve and they're just, we're just looking for a quick fix. Again, it's like you said, it's not a fit.
Right? Yeah, exactly. Like, we don't do quick and dirty. We don't cut corners. Yeah. That's our fundamental thing. It's like, you're going to get the well-architected, robust, reliable system from us. And we're not going to give you something cheap that will break, you know, so.
Yeah. Well, I think being picky like that with the projects you select, it means you don't end up with things that you end up in trouble on because you're overextending or the value's not there. And now, you know what I mean? You're charging somebody for something that they feel doesn't have the value. And it just means you get better customers.
Absolutely. Too, I mean,
you know,
qualification is a two-way street. You know, I qualify the customer, they qualify me back. So.
Exactly. Yeah. So once you've got a qualified customer, let's say, so what kind of relationship do you, you know, working relationship do you create with that client? I mean, are you sending an army of engineers out on their site for 6 months? Do you do everything remote and virtual? Is a lot of travel involved? How do you kind of communicate with them and work with them? What does that look like?
Sure. Now, in the consulting field, it's almost impossible to get away from some amount of travel. And, you know, there have been times where I've been traveling like 25%, so 1 week out of every month or so on. But, you know, sometimes we go to two ends of that. You know, we have a full fabrication shop, a full fabrication lab locally. So quite often we'll try to get as much done here as we can before delivering to a customer. But the magic always happens at the customer site. So we'll often be there kind of deploying and testing and refining and making sure that's in place, even if it takes several intermediate trips. Now, we did have a customer even earlier this year where they were setting up a gigantic assembly line with a whole bunch of modules that had to talk to each other. Mm-hmm. There's no way we're going to pull that back and set it up in our office. So we went to Iowa for 8 weeks, and we had two dedicated engineers and a project manager there for that time period trying to get it done because they had to finish it, and then they had to send it to China. So that we were certainly, you know, a part of the kind of supply chain there for them. So having embedded engineers there is something that we also offer. And it's completely scalable. You know, we can come for an afternoon and walk you through your LabVIEW code and give you some advice and shake your hand and walk away. And that happens quite often. You know, we have a training mystique about us that, you know, it's something that we've always done. Or you can have an embedded engineer that's there for 6 months to get your project done.
Yeah, it's funny, isn't it, how, you know, the deployment of machinery and sort of systems and so forth, you know, in the physical world is so different than the software world, right? I mean, you know, if it's just come in and installing, like you said, a LabVIEW program, well, as long as you have VPN or something, you can do that from anywhere potentially, right? But then in some of these factories, I mean, I've seen plenty of customers where, like you said, some parts are made in a small fabrication shop, shipped to somewhere in the US where it's all put together and then shipped to China, you know, in a much, much bigger chunk. Right.
Exactly.
And just the logistics of that get incredibly complicated. It's interesting.
Yeah. And we try to be flexible. We're there to make the customer's life easier. So we're not going to force them to, you know, do something that's not efficient for them. But, you know, we've gone to UK, we've gone to Israel, we've gone to Malaysia to deploy things. It's not like we only operate out of our local city here, although that is certainly nicer for commute periods. But
yeah,
quite often with a customer, define the level of effort to certain level. And it's kind of something that we address in the kickoff meeting. We have procedures in place for all these sort of things. We'll say, hey, we can test these things and give you intermediate reports. We can give you intermediate deliveries, and then we can deliver on site. And that's quite often what they'll go for. But, you know, they'll also say, we'll make a desk for you. Now, you mentioned the difference between software and hardware engineering, but we're starting to actually have to pick up a number of things from, say, you know, app developers and so on like that. You know, for right now, we have this system, again, with that customer from the UK that I mentioned, where they have a whole bunch of distributed embedded systems that are controlling things. Some of them are local here in Pittsburgh, some of them are in the UK. And they wanted a, you know, I can just open up an iPad and see what all of them are doing in every country. Now, they still want updates to that. So in that, we can't go to every oven that they're running in every country and deploy like that. So we had to set up a deployment system like you have with Excel or with Twitter or what have you, where the app on your phone will be like, oh, I just received an update push and I need to update locally. So we've had to set up that kind of infrastructure as well to support our customers. Because another big thing we try to emphasize is that we're not going to, you know, deliver and then wash our hands and walk away. We really want to educate and support you throughout the entire cycle of everything that goes on. And our best customers have really reacted well to that, where we've gone through 3, 4, 5 revisions of their product because, you know, they're updating their product, so they need more tests, so they need more fixtures. And so everything kind of gets cycled through that way.
You know, that seems like it's a real big pain that I've heard folks talk about when it comes to the type of machinery we're kind of talking about here, is basically the fact that there's so much travel involved on their part to go to these facilities just to plug into a serial port and update a robot, for instance, right? Folks have told me they have, you know, these are their partners of mine and companies I know that they've been in places that'll have 100 robots, but they're none of them have any kind of network connection or not connected at all. And I mean, you physically have to plug into every single one and patch it or give it a new program, right? And so kind of supplying that, I guess you might call it middleware, right? That does, you know, that says, hey, there's an update that needs to be applied to 12 out of these 50 robots, right? You know, that is a custom thing that doesn't always exist sometimes. And if the guy can sit at his desk in Tennessee and install that in Japan or something, I mean, you know, rather than flying to Japan, that is a personal pain.
And it's an efficiency thing too. I mean, it's saving everybody money, it's saving everybody time, and it can really help out. There are some tools that seem to be coming out right now that we're not going to have to roll our own quite as much as we have in the past. Have we been burnt by accepting a new tool before it's ready for prime time? Yes, but you know, there's certain ones that are getting tested out and that are being rolled out by National Instruments, who we've always kind of trusted from a software perspective, that might help us out quite a bit with that. So it's an exciting time for remote access and things like that. So
Well, and speaking of business kind of all over the world, I'm curious what have changes in just sort of the global economy, how have those changes affected your clients? What kind of impact have you seen from that?
Well, we've certainly seen everything from trade to regulation affect us. I mean, the only reason I got to do that Mercury power plant thing was because of an EPA regulation that got passed, right? And also, you know, over the past 10 years, you know, even though Pittsburgh is kind of this, well, at least used to be the center for steel and so on, you go to a lot of these steel plants and they don't have any money for internal infrastructure, you know, so, you know, they're in such big trade wars that they just don't have capital expense things. Now that's changed recently. We've certainly seen a lot more open up from that perspective, but, you know, even just, you know, things that happen in the news, like, you know, the whole Boeing issue with their planes getting grounded and having to be redone. You know, we're four stages removed from that, but we're definitely seeing that. You know, we have clients that make testers that do the torque meters that go onto those planes. So they're, you know, several stages in the supply chain removed, but Boeing is basically shutting their processes down. So it's interesting to see how the economy is moving for all that.
And whenever that, you know, that 800-pound gorilla in an industry makes a move, the ripple effect throughout so many, you know, things that you wouldn't even think would be affected, you know, some lubricant manufacturer in Ohio somewhere that you didn't even know does anything with Boeing, right? I mean, there's so many companies and jobs that can get affected when that, you know, Boeing and the size that they are makes any choice. You know, so many things are dependent on some of these very large companies.
Yeah,
sometimes.
Absolutely. Now, a nice thing as well, we're a member of what we call the Control Systems Integrator Association. I mean, I guess we don't call it. We join them. They name themselves. But every year at their conference, they have kind of an industry analysis and where's the economy going in the future that we've always found very useful. You know, so there are a bunch of implementations about, you know, what jobs robotics are creating. You know, so often in the news you hear, oh, robots and automation are destroying jobs or so on. But there's, it's like, okay, well, if you actually analyze it, it's making 120% of the jobs that were lost. So, you know, because of, like we're saying, we need more infrastructure, we need more IT, we need more people running these web services, we need more people maintaining them. So it's not the working on the plant line job, but it is a bunch of people supporting this automation process that is in place.
Well, and arguably those are higher paying jobs. I mean, the software developers building control systems for the robots get paid more than the guy who would have hand assembled the car seat.
Yep.
Right. You know, and now there's fewer of those jobs needed because, you know, you only need three developers to write the software for millions of robots. Right.
But,
you know, that's not necessarily true either. I mean, you might need hundreds of developers.
And even like I mentioned, you know, we have people who are now laying internet cable and they're, you know, doing the power plants that are dedicated to these server farms out there. You know, there are all kinds of levels of jobs that are being supported by just the fact that there's automation and cloud computing.
Oh, exactly. Yeah. When you look at the tools and technologies you're working with right now, you know, if we were to talk, say, 3 years from now, what sort of technologies and sort of solutions do you want to get into in that time frame that you think you'll be doing sort of 3 years from now, let's say?
I think the big thing that we want to get into is the cloud-based computing. Now, it's a buzzword right now, of course. We both know some smart people who are into Microsoft Azure and so on, but it is really driven from our customers. They don't want to have to go plug into a computer and get a report or have some guy walk out to something and find out what the data is. They want the central headquarters to know what all of their plants are doing at any one time. They want the analysis to be happening independently. So once you've trained these systems, so you can just say, hey, it's sending me a flag that there's going to be an inventory shortage in 3 weeks if we continue on the way we're going right now because we have an imbalance in our shipping. It really seems like the automation is going to be another level. It's not going to be the robot on the assembly line. It's going to be the automation of the whole process of where the parts are coming from, when they're getting assembled, when they're coming out, when they're getting packaged. So it's going to be an efficiency in that line that we're really going to see. In addition, the cost of these embedded computers and so on is becoming lower and lower. I mean, you know, 8 years ago, you know, who had heard of Arduino or Raspberry Pi or any of these computers on a chip. And, you know, nowadays we're getting up to where we're having industrial processes being run on things like the Intel Galileo platform and even some of the more advanced Arduino. And, you know, right now, one of the most competitive imaging solutions on the market is built on the Raspberry Pi platform. So I think the hardware is becoming reliable. You know, it's no longer hobby level cheapness. It's becoming reliable and embedded, and I'm going to have, you know, everything talking to everything else. And I wanted to say it that way first before I started dropping, oh, Internet of Things, right? You know, the thing that gets thrown around all the place. But I'm literally seeing more and more things talking to each other, more and more things reporting their status back to a central location, and people doing very good decision-making and very good business planning based off that, that I think is really driving the industry and the Internet of maybe the industrial Internet of Things, IIoT rather than IoT, would be the more appropriate thing to say.
Absolutely. And you know, I think it's interesting to me too, and with regards to cloud and cloud infrastructure, the sort of strategic decisions that people are kind of inventing, or it's allowing them to do, that I've heard recently that, you know, you wouldn't necessarily first think of. So for instance, there's a very large company that I'm familiar with, that they sort of in the next 5 years would like to spin off a lot of divisions. Let's say they have thousands of divisions, and they'll probably spin off, I don't know, X number of them. So they are trying to go everything to cloud, everything, right? Well, why? Well, because they currently have maybe 12, 15, 20 data centers across the globe with just a myriad of servers stacked and intermixed together for all the various divisions, right? So if you sell a large, you know, let's say $1 billion division to your closest competitor, they don't really want their servers in your data center anymore, right? Well, what does it cost to go through, figure out which servers are where, who owns what, and then take them and move them all out? Oh, and plus, each server might have multiple departments or division software running on it.
Yeah, maybe you can't even divide it at the server level. It's split.
Yeah. And then, well, exactly. And then who has access to it? What users, what passwords? A lot of money, tens of millions of dollars easily to go through and split up and then recondense these data centers, right? Whereas if the entire company is running on, say, Azure, it's a command line. You know, you say, because you have all your servers grouped, all these virtual servers belong to one division. And you just run a simple script that takes away all these users' access and gives it to a different set.
Yeah, you're increasing the liquidity of your servers,
and then you're done. Exactly. So it's almost like a real estate opportunity. Like in the same way that, you know, maybe I don't know, if you're a trucking company or something, it's better to have just a couple main depots than to have hundreds of depots, because who wants to buy a company that has that, like, too many locations, right? So it's interesting because it's like they're making their sort of acquisition, merger, agility higher by moving into cloud. Has nothing to do with cost or technology or anything like that, you know? Thought that was kind of interesting. So definitely a lot of changes in that space. Recently, what do you think is kind of the most personally rewarding project you've worked on recently that you've kind of got the most out of?
So, like we mentioned, kind of customer interaction is a big thing for us, and it's nice to have a nice, loyal customer, and maybe loyal is not the way, a rewarding customer. We have one, they make dry eye treatment, but it's a division of Allergan. So Allergan's a giant pharmaceutical company. This group was acquired by them, where it's actually a device you stick up your nose, and it makes your eyes water, all right? Much more technologically efficient than pulling a nose hair, let's just put it that way. And you know, I've had personal friends who have lost corneas and everything like that to dry eye. It's a very serious condition. So it's nice, number one, to be able to have something that's personally affecting people. But number two, we've really become, we were brought in just to do a regression tester. But at this point, we make all of their fixtures and software that tests their new software in their R&D department. We're part of their entire fabrication process. So we test the boards before they're assembled. We test their batteries. We test the charging system for it. We test it after it's assembled. We serialize it, package it, So we're doing the whole cradle to grave for their entire process. And that was the one I was mentioning. We had their version 1. We had their version 1.5. We're now just delivered their version 2.0. That they've been so satisfied with our returning efficiency and our product that we've given them that kind of reward. And that's just being the project manager on something like that is great. But DSA is also involved in the community. So I had kind of brought up the idea of getting involved in the FIRST robotics program. So this is the robotics program that is intended to teach all kinds of levels. There's the high school level, and then there's like VEX, and then there's even a Lego division essentially for elementary students. And it was founded by Dean Kamen. All right. So for those who don't know, segued to a whole bunch of other kind of amazing invention stuff. And I met him at NI Week. So when I was winning an award for actually that Mercury monitoring system, see, this comes full circle. He had just convinced NI to donate the embedded brains that are going in all of these projects across every FIRST robotics team in the country. So the Compact Rio platform and LabVIEW was the new product that was these robots were being built upon. So to that end, I'm like, well, we should be teaching these people. We teach LabVIEW, so let's go and teach our local high school. So we would do a seminar at the beginning of every season and teach all the local Pittsburgh high schools how to use LabVIEW and what the environment's like and how to get your robot working so they don't have to worry about that technical side of things. And then I would go around to different schools to train them on that side. And even at the event, you know, I basically would wander around the pits where they're putting these robots together and help them sort out control systems issues before they went out to compete out there. And that was really, really rewarding just to see kind of the future robotics engineers training and how excited they got about it and everything like that. So that was a big thing that I'm really glad that we got involved in.
Yeah, it's awesome because, in my experience, I recently was asked to speak at a local high school, and I kind of thought I'd be talking about computer science, but really the kids just want to talk about video games, right? Which is fine. I mean, nothing wrong with that, but that's not exactly what most people in the industry do, right? And so it sounds like you were doing a little bit more, maybe a little bit more practical, maybe real world. I mean, people do actually do robotics stuff a lot more maybe than they write video
games.
Well,
that's actually been a problem. In the control systems realm, we're getting a lot of talented engineers who are graduating who want to write apps for the phone or want to build the next Bluetooth headset or stuff like that. And these are all valuable things. These are all things that I use, but we're kind of losing the skill set to the new hot thing, and we're not getting controls engineers and so on.
Yep.
So I'm doing hopefully a little bit of my part to get them excited about, hey, it's cool to make motors spin and capture images and make decisions and things like that at a low level or at a non-fit in your pocket level.
Exactly. Yeah, because I mean, that's the thing is not everybody. I mean, there's without a doubt, there's always a shortage of technical talent, I suppose, but not everybody is going to work on Call of Duty, you know. And I think not everybody would really want to once they got into it. I mean, that is a rough gig. I mean, those game studios are rather tough places to work. So no, that's awesome. How do clients sort of find you? You think I know what you've. You know, we've talked a little bit about you do a lot of workshops and training and how that, sounds like that might be a pretty good way for you to market your services or you achieve a lot.
I mean, it is a big thing.
Correct?
We teach a lot of courses. So a number of customers will have a LabVIEW or an automation challenge ahead of them. And so they'll come take a course with us. And whether it's just your kind of intro to LabVIEW or one of the more kind of advanced courses in acquisition or vision analysis or embedded development, like I mentioned, they get to interact with us for a whole week. And the nice thing about taking a course from us is that we've been in the trenches, as it were, right? You know, I'm not teaching just theory and reading off of slides. I can give you examples of things that I've had in place. I can, tell you about my experiences. I can quote my computer science roommate and the things he told me about state machine theory back in the day, So I can, really give that kind of idea. And, quite often we'll train them to the level where they can do it themselves, which makes our competitors completely confused. They're like, why are you training these people so that they can put you out of business? It's like, well, we want them to trust us. We want them to know that we're never going to hide anything from them. We're always going to educate them on what they got, even to the end that when you finish with us, you get unlocked source code from us. You know, we don't retain a password protection or anything like that. We never keep you hostage at the end. But sometimes they're like, wow, okay, this is cool, and I've gotten a little bit up this slope, but this is way too much time for me to handle. Maybe these guys who I just saw demonstrate their expertise can help us out instead. And that has been a really large lead generator for us in general. You know, we had a project that was two years of a 5-engineer team. So, you know, 10 man years of effort that came out of a guy recommending us from a training class. So, and I mean, we have a full-time marketing group as well, being members of a number of industry associations, like the Control Systems Integrator Association, like the Pittsburgh Tech Council, like the PA Life Sciences Association. We have kind of exist on registers that we'll have some inquiries come into, but we also go out and find people. We have kind of our wish list of people we'd like to work with that we kind of update. We have outside salesmen dedicated to going and kind of finding customers, convincing them, you know, that we're the best solution to their problem. So there's not really one answer to your question, Sam, but those are the different places we approach it from.
Well, it's omnichannel, you know, which is what everybody wants to do nowadays, you know, go on podcasts, go on trade groups, everything, you know, and you have to, because no one channel will produce.
And like I said,
it's the bottom line, you know,
there's kind of my three biggest accounts. One was a call came into us because they found us on a web search. That's that eye treatment group that has turned into a 3-year project. Mm-hmm. The big one that we said came out of a class. And then, you know, our latest one, we just were kind of in Cleveland. We're like, hey, those guys look kind of big. Let's talk to them. And we've had 15 projects with them over the last 5 years. So,
wow. Excellent. So what are the, you know, for folks out there listening that may work at companies that are having some of these types of problems, or at least running machinery and doing some of this stuff, what are the kind of the three main problems that they might be having that they should reach out to your firm or you for help
with? A big thing that we help people with is getting from your prototype to your product. So quite often you get something, you work it, and you need to get it so you can start ramping up manufacturing. And we can help you get that so you can design for tests, so you can design for manufacturing. So that's we can help you with your product side of things. The next thing is you are confused about something that is going wrong in your process. And so we can give you the extra analysis tools that can help you sort out things. So that's kind of the second area that can really help you out. And then third, frankly, we're kind of guns for hire. You're like, you have smart people. They can do this job. If only you had 5 more of them. And so you can bring us in, we can work with your people, we can supplement or, you know, help our processes and just get a project done that you just haven't been able to get over the finish line. I would say those are the three main areas that we could really help people out with.
Great. So if folks want to reach out to ask you questions about any of those things,
sure. Our website is dsautomation.com. We'd love to have dsa.com, but I think that's owned by some Chinese shipping company. And you can reach me at TDN, as in Tim David Nolan, at dsautomation.com, or our central number, which is 724-942-6330.
Great. Well, Tim, thanks so much for coming on the show and talking to me about what you've been working on. You and I have known each other for a very long time. That I wouldn't even want to admit, probably almost 20, exactly. 25 years, perhaps. So it's really awesome to kind of remembering where you started in college and such, and just seeing the expertise you've gained that obviously, you know, you really have a lot of mastery over helping customers through these like really complicated problems. So it's very cool to see.
I'm glad we no longer have to use our modem to dial up in to get our email at college like we used to have to. So things have come a long way.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, long distance, high quality audio. Absolutely. It's amazing.
Thank you, sir.
All right, thank you.
Thank you for tuning in to Unstoppable Talk. We hope you enjoyed today's podcast. If you did, be sure to support the show by leaving a 5-star review on iTunes. And learn more about this show by heading over to unstoppablesoftware.com. Until next time, keep innovating.